Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I hit him. Those are the words of the defendant. Four times, you heard testimony from four different witnesses who overheard and observed those statements from the defendant on January 29th, 2022. You heard testimony from firefighter Timothy Nuttall. He was trying to bag Val Mask, Mr. O'Keefe. He was working on resuscitative efforts to try to save Mr. O'Keefe's life. He asked if anyone saw anything or knew what happened. And the defendant said, I hit him. Firefighter Anthony Famati was asking if anyone had information on why Mr. O'Keefe was there in the snow. The defendant repeatedly said, I hit him. Oh my God, I hit him. Firefighter Katie McLaughlin was tasked by Firefighter Famati with asking for biographical information and for what the cause was of the traumatic injuries that all the firefighters testified that they observed on Mr. O'Keefe. She asked the defendant, and the defendant said, I hit him, repeatedly. Firefighter McLaughlin asked for clarification. You did what? And the defendant repeated, I hit him. Jennifer McKay stated initially over the phone when speaking with the defendant that the defendant said, could I have hit him in the car while they're on the phone with Ms. Roberts going from Ms. McCabe's house to Mr. O'Keefe's house. Did I hit him? Could I have hit him? Once on scene, once asked, as Ms. McCabe described by an EMT, for name, age, things like that related to Mr. O'Keefe, what caused the trauma? She indicated in her testimony that the defendant said repeatedly, I hit him. You heard a testimony from Officer Sarif, statements that he attributed to the defendant as saying that morning, this is all my fault. This is all my fault. I did this. This is what the defendant is saying on scene. Since then, stories changed a little bit. But those were the words that came from the defendant's mouth on January 29th, 2022, as John O'Keefe lay dying on the front lawn of 34 Fairview Road, where the defendant had left him after striking him with her motor vehicle several hours before and then left him freezing there in a blizzard. There's certain things that have come up over the course of this trial as far as evidence and testimony concerned, little things. And what I would suggest to you, it's those little things that are quite telling as it pertains to the defendant's statements and the defendant's actions over the course of January 28th and January 29th and beyond. And I'm going to bring some of those to your attention as I go through, but just ask you to keep that in mind as far as when you're deliberating, when you're reviewing this testimony and this evidence. The little things matter. The little things start piling up in this case. Throughout the course of this trial, you've heard a lot of purported evidence or questions of witnesses in an attempt to distract you from the evidence in this case. It's essentially defense by obfuscation. It's a three-card monitor. Facts and the evidence in this case are your card, they're the queen of hearts. And so what I want you to, or what the defense wants you to do is not look at that card, look at anything else. Look at movement, look at this person, look at that person, look at text messages, look at this. Don't pay attention to the facts and the evidence, because if you do, what it will ineluctably lead you to is that the defendant is guilty of each of the three indictments before this court. The evidence and the facts of this case are for you, the jury, to decide. Using your common sense, using your life experiences as your guide through that as you go. Before I turn to that evidence that I will submit to you ineluctably demonstrates the defendant's guilt, let me first just address Trooper Proctor. The text messages from Trooper Proctor are unprofessional, they're indefensible, they're inexcusable. However, as distasteful as those messages are, and their content is, I submit they had no bearing whatsoever or impact whatsoever on the integrity of the entirety of the investigation that Massachusetts State Police collectively conducted into John O'Keefe's death here. As was asked of Trooper Proctor on cross-examination, these were texts from his personal phone that he never thought would see the light of day. He was asked whether or not he ever thought that he would be asked about these in a courtroom, put to him as sort of a safe space, a safe place for him to discuss, if you will. What do you not see in those text messages? You don't see any discussion or any illusion of any conspiracy, of any framing of the defendant, of any planting of any evidence, no evidence whatsoever. Why? Because it didn't happen. There is no conspiracy, there is no cover-up, there is no evidence of any of that beyond speculation, rampant speculation and conjecture on behalf of the defense. Two things can be true at the same time. They're mutually exclusive. The texts from Trooper Proctor are distasteful, they're disrespectful, they're unprofessional, there's no defense to them. And the defendant killed John O'Keefe. Turning to the evidence, let me first talk a little bit about John O'Keefe. You heard a lot about him over the course of this trial, about his selfless story through his family and friends that loved him, including his adopted niece and nephew. You heard a lot about the lives he touched and the different people who he had friendships with. You heard a lot about from those particular friends and from his family. Turning to what I would submit to you as a timeline. This may be a little hard to see up here. What I'm going to go is from left to right. January 28th, 2022, 9:49 in the morning, Karen and John begin fighting over text messages. 2:25 p.m. in the afternoon, the defendant texts Mr. O'Keefe, "Tell me if you are interested in someone else. Can't think of any other reason you've been like this." John texts back, "Nope." 2:25, Mr. O'Keefe texts the defendant, "Things haven't been great between us for a while. Ever consider that?" This is also testimony that you heard through multiple sources, whether it be phones, whether it be from the children, whether it be from other friends or family members as to the relationship in the months and weeks leading up to John's murder. 2:32 p.m., John texts the defendant, "Sick of always arguing and fighting. It's been weekly for several months now." He then texts the defendant, "OMG, stop calling." This is during the time frame that Trooper Guarino was talking about, with 18 phone calls, most of which were rejected, some of which were missed, and a couple of which were answered over the course of this afternoon, as she's continuing to needle and try to engage him in a fight that he doesn't want to have. 2:33 p.m., the defendant texts John, "So you're not into this anymore." 2:34 p.m., John texts the defendant, "I am not answering, stop calling." The defendant then texts John, "Then stop starting with me." 2:38 p.m., the defendant texts John, "I'm going to grab a drink in a bit." 2:38 in the afternoon. Around 3 p.m. is the testimony you heard from Erin O'Keefe in regard to the defendant texting her, asking if she can go out without her husband, Paul, asking to go out for a drink. This is while Erin O'Keefe testified she was waiting for one of her children at the bus stop, picking that child up around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This is also the point in which the defendant says to Ms. O'Keefe, "Wish I didn't speak to another O'Keefe after 2004. 7:30 p.m., you have Mr. O'Keefe and Mr. Camerano arriving at C.F. McCarthy's, with the defendant arriving at 8:51. 8:58 p.m. is when the defendant receives drink number one at C.F. McCarthy's. Vodka soda, tall cylinder glass, lime and a straw. 9:13 p.m., drink number two. 9:20 p.m., drink number three. 9:33 p.m., drink number four. 9:57 p.m., drink number five. 10:22 p.m., drink number six. 10:29 p.m., drink number seven. Seven drinks from 8:58 p.m. through 10:29 p.m. when she receives that last drink at CF MacArthur's, the drink that she indicates to Sergeant Mechanic and several others on the next day that she did not take with her from CF MacArthur's to the waterfall, which several individuals at the waterfall testify that she produced from her coat when she walked in, and that you can clearly see on the CF MacArthur's video her walking out the door with the same tall cylinder glass in her right hand. Now, keeping understanding that some of these drinks are not the full tall cylinder drinks, what she's doing is she's getting shot glasses of vodka and then pouring them into the drink after she's consumed the drink. 10:54 p.m., the defendant and Mr. O'Keefe arrive at the waterfall, during the course of which, on an hour that they're there, the defendant receives drinks number eight and drinks number nine. 12:10 a.m., from the waterfall video, you have Ms. McCabe, Ms. Kolokithis, and the defendant departing the waterfall together. Interestingly, around the same time, you also have the text and screenshot communications between Colin Albert and Allison McCabe in reference to him getting picked up at that time. You also have testimony from Brian Albert, Nicole Albert, Caitlin Albert, Brian Albert Jr. in reference to them sort of walking in from the waterfall as Colin Albert is walking out of 34 Fairview Road, gets picked up by Ms. McCabe, and then is driven home. 1 minute later, 12:11, Mr. O'Keefe is then on the waterfall video walking out with cocktail glass in his right hand. At 12:14 a.m., Mr. O'Keefe texts Ms. McCabe, where to? 12:14 a.m., based on the fact that she's driving, and Ms. McCabe indicated in his testimony that she should call him instead of texting while driving, Ms. McCabe calls John O'Keefe and speaks with him regarding directions, sort of going over which way to come in, Chapman Street, over Cedar Crest, as far as coming into Fairview Road. 12:15:38 a.m., the defendant's vehicle drives by the Canton Library. You can see that on the video. 12:17:56, the defendant drives by the Temple Beth Abraham video. Again, you can see that on the video. Remember also the testimony from Lieutenant Tully in regard to the CSLI data and the ranging data in reference to it coinciding with what you observed, the black SUV, from each of those respective videos. 12:19:32, Mr. O'Keefe enters 34 Fairview Road into his Waze app on his phone. 12:23 a.m. is when the defendant conducts a three-point turn on Cedar Crest and travels back toward Fairview. That's from Mr. O'Keefe's GPS native location data from his phone. Around the same time at 12:23 and 12:24 is when you have that testimony from Ryan Nagel, Heather Maxson, and Ricky D'Antono, pulling into Fairview Road around the same time and pulling in behind the dark SUV. 12:25 a.m. is the last native location GPS data of John O'Keefe's phone. It's in that area between 32 and 34 Fairview Road where his body is discovered the next time, the next morning, in which there is no movement of that phone from that 12:25 a.m. period until Ms. Roberts then picks up the phone on the grass underneath Mr. O'Keefe's body sometime after 6 a.m. What you have up on the screen right now is that data, those plotting points that Trooper Guarino was testifying about as far as the movement of the vehicle. The movement of the vehicle as it comes down Cedar Crest, passes by Fairview, reverses direction, and then comes down Fairview, moving up, as the witnesses described, eventually stopping in that area of the property line between 32 and 34 Fairview Road, which happens to coincide with the vehicle control history database information from the Toyota tech stream, which you now have up on the screen before you here, indicating that following that three-point turn, approximately 8 minutes after that, from Trooper Paul's testimony, as far as the mileage, 36 to 38 miles, matching up with the time that the vehicle is in front of 34 Fairview Road, that the vehicle travels in reverse, in a straight line, were 24.2 miles per hour for 62 and a half feet with a minor steering angle change, which the trooper indicated was consistent with a pedestrian collision. At 12:30 a.m., you have that second triggering event 8 minutes after the three-point turn when the vehicle is in reverse at 24.2 miles an hour. 12:35 is when the defendant calls John, and that's unanswered. 12:36 is around the time that the defendant's phone connects to the Wi-Fi at One Meadows Ave, Mr. O'Keefe's home. 12:37 is when the defendant leaves this voicemail. So within minutes of that vehicle's data, going 24.2 miles an hour in reverse for 62 and a half feet, the defendant leaves that voicemail, seething in rage as she's screaming, "John, I fucking hate you." 12:40 to 12:42, Ms. McCabe is texting Mr. O'Keefe. She tries calling Mr. O'Keefe, gets no answer. If you recall from her testimony around this time frame, about 12:40, she was unsure whether the vehicle was actually still out front or if it had gone at that point. But she was looking for John because she had seen the defendant's vehicle in front of the house and no one had come in. So she was wondering where her friend, Mr. O'Keefe, was. 12:55, the defendant texts John, "See you later." 12:59, the defendant calls, leaves another voicemail for Mr. O'Keefe. Exhibit 637, it sounded like this.
"John, I'm here with your fucking kids. Nobody knows what the fuck you are, you fucking pervert."
But somebody did know where Mr. O'Keefe was. The defendant knew exactly where he was. She had driven him there, she had struck him there, she had left him to die there. 1:02 a.m., the defendant leaves another voicemail with no content. And then she texts John, "Your kids are fucking alone." 1:09 a.m., the defendant texts John, "I'm back in Mansfield. The kids are home alone." She's not. GPS, as far as it never disconnects from the Wi-Fi until the following morning. There's no indication that Ms. Reed left and went to her home in Mansfield at any point. 1:10 a.m., the defendant calls her parents. 1:11 a.m., she calls Mr. O'Keefe and leaves this voicemail.
"John, I'm going home. I cannot babysit Amy. I need to go home. You are fucking using me right now. You're fucking another girl. Kim's sleeping next to me. You're a fucking loser. Fuck yourself."
1:18 a.m., the defendant leaves another voicemail. Now, about 1:43 or 1:45 a.m. is when Julie Nagel testified that they were leaving the house. And she sees a large black object on the lawn near the flagpole while leaving 34 Fairview Road. Doesn't think much of it at the time, isn't expecting Mr. O'Keefe or any body to be out on the front lawn. 4:42 a.m., the defendant calls and speaks. The calls to her parents are finally answered. 4:49 a.m., the defendant calls Ms. Camerano, screaming, "Where's Mike?" 4:53 in the morning is when the defendant instructs Kaylee, Mr. O'Keefe's niece, to call Ms. McCabe. Why? Because the defendant doesn't have Ms. McCabe's phone number. Indicates that John didn't come home. "We got in a fight and I left him at the waterfall." Those are the first statements or the first version of events that she's able to communicate out to the world as to what happened to Mr. O'Keefe and where he is. "We got into a fight. I left him at the waterfall." 5 a.m., the defendant calls Kerry Roberts saying, "John's dead. Kerry, hangs up the phone. 5:01, the defendant calls Kerry Roberts again. And it's at this point that she indicates that John's dead, he must have been hit by a plow. 5:07 a.m., the defendant leaves One Meadows Ave. You have the video of that, it's number 153 in Exhibit 6. We'll get to that a little more in a moment. About 5:10 a.m., the defendant calls Kerry Roberts. Ms. Roberts starts calling hospitals, calling KCPD, calling 911. Something that you would do if you didn't know where Mr. O'Keefe was for all of these hours, that all of these other phone calls are being made and these text messages are being sent and calling your parents and all of these other things, no calls to 911 from the defendant, while John O'Keefe is laying, freezing, and dying from a brain injury and a skull fracture on the front lawn of 34 Fairview Road. 5:11 a.m., the defendant's vehicle is seen on the Canton Library camera heading towards the waterfall. Seems to be sort of retracing steps. 5:18 a.m., the defendant's vehicle is seen at Washington Street and Chapman on the Temple Beth Abraham video heading in the same direction that it was the night before when it was heading to 34 Fairview Road. 5:35 is when the defendant arrives at Ms. McCabe's house. Ms. Roberts arrives shortly thereafter. Both of them see the broken taillight at that time in the driveway. Now that gap of 5:18 to 5:35 is way too much time to be driving from the area of the waterfall to Jennifer McCabe's house. And as I indicated a moment before, heading in the same directionality, retracing the steps from the night before, heading towards 34 Fairview Road. Why is it that the defendant can see Mr. O'Keefe when they eventually get to Fairview Road and no one else can? It's because she knew exactly where he was. She had hit him and left him there the night before, and she had gone back during that time frame between 5:18 a.m. when she's seen on the Temple video and 5:35 when she arrives at Ms. McCabe's house. 5:33 is when the defendant, Ms. McCabe, and Ms. Roberts return to One Meadows Ave searching for John. 6:03 is when the defendant, and no one else, spots Mr. O'Keefe's body buried in the snow. Exhibit 12, indicating this cruiser camera video, which I know you've seen a dozen times before. So where I'm starting it from this point and this part right here is the spotlight that Officer Sarif had to use in order to locate, even with a vehicle of Ms. Roberts, parked right in the middle of the road. In the darkness, in the snow, in the blizzard, in those conditions, the defendant sitting in the back seat of the vehicle knows exactly where Mr. O'Keefe is, covered in snow, as you heard from all of the paramedics, from the civilian witnesses, from the first responders. But the defendant knows exactly where he is. 6:07 a.m., Ms. McCabe calls 911. 6:08, the defendant leaves that 4 or 5 minute voicemail, leaving the phone in the car for some reason to Mr. O'Keefe's phone. 6:23 and 6:24 in the morning is when Ms. McCabe conducts those Google searches. 7:50 in the morning is when Mr. O'Keefe is pronounced deceased at Good Samaritan Hospital. 4:13 to 4:20 p.m. is when the defendant's SUV is towed from her parents' house in Dighton. 5:20 p.m. is when the search team arrives in the area of 34 Fairview Road to conduct the search for evidence. 5:30 p.m. is when the defendant's vehicle arrives at the Canton Police Department south. To circle back for a moment to Mr. O'Keefe, to his families, to his friends, and to his relationship with the defendant. You heard testimony from Paul and Aaron O'Keefe that they liked the defendant, that they thought he was good for John, thought he was good for the kids. All outward appearances of the relationship were good. And you heard testimony from the children that that was not true behind closed doors. But Paul O'Keefe testified that he told the defendant's parents this, that he liked Miss Reed, that he thought that she was good for John, thought that she was good for the kids, weeks before John's murder. He even blew her a kiss in the emergency department at Good Samaritan as he was walking out and she was still being treated while they were there. Invited her over to John's house to grieve with him. Invited her to sit down with him while he explained to their nephew Patrick about John's passing. Defendant shows up at the house. Abruptly goes upstairs with her father for a period of about 15 minutes, which is about half of the time that she spent there that morning grieving with the family. She left with a bag of her belongings, drove with her family there, and then took an extra vehicle in the height of the blizzard, around 12, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, drive that vehicle all the way from Canton, where it was parked at her boyfriend's house, where she stayed over on many occasions, drove that vehicle or felt the need to drive that vehicle from Canton all the way down to her parents' house in Dighton at the height of the blizzard. You heard testimony from Aaron O'Keefe of the text messages on and the phone call on January 28th. You've heard that Aaron O'Keefe called the defendant on the morning of the 29th because she was concerned for her. She wanted to know what was going on with someone she considered her friend. The defendant yells, "John is dead." Ms. Robertson grabs the phone and then updates Aaron O'Keefe as to what's going on with John. Aaron O'Keefe again calls back later because she's concerned for someone that she considered her friend. How does the defendant respond? These are some of the little things. The defendant indicates to Ms. O'Keefe that she just has to remember the bad times and indicates to her, "I don't think I'll ever see you guys." This is after she's done her quick in and out at One Meadows Ave and is now with her parents or with her father, driving that car, essentially taking the murder weapon from Canton and bringing it down to her parents' house in Dighton. She's indicating over the phone to Aaron O'Keefe, "I don't think I'll ever see you guys again." Why? If she didn't kill John, why would she say that? You heard a lot of testimony about New Year's Eve and Aruba. You heard the testimony from Ms. O'Keefe in regard to them exchanging, her and the defendant exchanging text messages on the flight down, arranging times to meet up. And then the defendant telling Aaron via text message that she caught Johnny kissing Laura's sister in the hotel lobby. She got into an argument about it, and then they never met up. Meaning the defendant, Mr. O'Keefe, got into an argument about it, and she and Aaron O'Keefe never ended up meeting up in Aruba. You heard testimony consistent from Laura Sullivan, Marietta Sullivan, as well as the children. The kiss never happened. It never would happen. Based on the relationship, the godfather relationship that John O'Keefe had with Laura Sullivan, her family, and particularly Laura Sullivan's child. The defendant persists with this unfounded suspicion and accusations of infidelity in her text messages with Mr. O'Keefe, in her text messages with Mr. Higgins, where she's accusing Mr. O'Keefe of making out in the lobby with Marietta Sullivan. Both of the Sullivans and the children have the defendant and Mr. O'Keefe, following this incident with Marietta Sullivan, going into a room. Both of the children testified that they're in that room for about 20 to 25 minutes, and they're arguing, about the defendant indicating that Mr. O'Keefe kissed someone in the lobby. And you have Laura Sullivan's testimony, about 20 to 25 minutes after her sister comes out and states her displeasure about the defendant. It's about 20 to 25 minutes before Mr. O'Keefe comes out, and then he and Ms. Sullivan have a conversation. Ms. Sullivan indicates that Mr. O'Keefe's phone is essentially blowing up, lighting up with calls and texts from the defendant. I would submit similar to the afternoon of January 28th. Mr. O'Keefe says she's crazy and he needs to take this and goes off from there. Ms. Sullivan has later conversations with Mr. O'Keefe on this Aruba trip, asks him if he's okay, asks him if he's happy. She indicated in her testimony that Mr. O'Keefe shrugs it off and says, "It is what it is." You heard testimony from the children about the arguments in the weeks and the months. And I know this is a displeasure to the defense counsel that the children came in and actually testified as to what happened behind closed doors in the house.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.